Can we make sense of the new cholesterol guidelines?
The incidence of childhood obesity in the U.S.
What are the dangers and the benefits of all of those over-the-counter pain medications?
And evaluating child abuse.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on January 31st, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas, San Antonio.
Rick, I'll reveal to our listeners that I have to bless you because yesterday in discussing what we were going to record this week, I suggested the FDA's report on OTC pain meds and you groaned because the thing is over 200 pages long. So thank you for reading it. Let's take a look at that issue, which I think is a really huge public health issue.
Elizabeth, this is an extensive and somewhat exhaustive review of the cardiovascular risk of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory medications. There's been a tremendous amount of controversy about their use in people that have cardiovascular disease and even those that don't. And the question is, do they actually increase the risk of having cardiovascular events, heart attacks or stroke or sudden cardiac death? So this is an update from the FDA that reviews all the literature. Here's what the FDA report highlights. Diclofenac and the COX-2 inhibitors are associated with small but still serious vascular risk. There's roughly 3 excess major vascular events per 1,000 person years of treatment, and at least one of those being a fatal event. Ibuprofen was associated with a 2-fold increased risk in major vascular events, and naproxen was not associated with a major vascular event. Now, all treatments, regardless of which one, all of them were associated with hospitalizations for heart failure and with upper GI complications, that is primarily bleeding.
And as we've talked about before, when we take a look at these kinds of assessments, the absolute risk is actually really still quite low, irrespective of which of these pain relievers someone chooses.
And as I mentioned, it ends up being 3 major vascular events per 1,000 person years treated. So it is small. The other thing this report highlights is it's not limited to people with known vascular disease. Even people without known cardiovascular disease have an increased risk with these agents. So what the FDA is recommending is naproxen seems to be the safest with regard to cardiovascular events, although it may have a higher incidence of GI bleeding. And for those individuals that can't tolerate it, we use another agent, but at the lowest dose that's effective.
And of course, the thing that's glaringly missing here are other OTC pain meds, acetaminophen specifically, and aspirin.
Absolutely. We know that aspirin has a cardioprotective effect. What they couldn't address is whether the use of aspirin with a nonsteroidal kind of negates the increased cardiovascular risk. And the other thing they can't address is whether high doses have an increased risk of cardiovascular events.
Well, I guess I would also return to an observation I've made to you in the past as well. If you're in a lot of pain and someone says, well, this may very, very modestly increase your risk for a cardiovascular event, if I weigh that myself against pain relief on a day-by-day basis, I'm going to choose the pain relief and accept a certain amount of risk.
The nice thing about this kind of information is it's a shared decision. The patient needs to be aware that it can increase their cardiovascular risk, and they can weigh that against how much discomfort they're feeling.
What an excellent point. So since we're talking about shared decisions, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. That's a look at, goodness, what are we going to do with all this crazy information regarding the new cholesterol guidelines?
Usually we talk about studies or recommendations. This is an unusual report. One of the editorials just talks about guidelines in general and how they can be difficult to accept either by physicians or by patients when they upend what has been the previous thought. For example, we used to target therapy to a specific LDL cholesterol level. New recommendations say we don't do that. The other big controversy is the use of a risk calculator. For people that have a 10-year risk of having cardiovascular disease that's over 7.5%, the guidelines would say start them on a statin. According to many experts, that number overestimates the risk by 70 to 150%. What most of us suspect is that risk calculation is going to change over the next 6 months as we refine it. And then finally, at what percentage is the risk high enough to justify the harms or the potential harms of statins?
So far, I haven't heard anything that says this is the right thing to do.
I've reviewed these guidelines extensively, and what I have to give the authors credit for is the fact that they used evidence-based medicine.
And that's all very well, but as I've suggested before, I think it's going to take a long time for this to penetrate the public consciousness and make it acceptable. And as you've already said, these are things that are going to continue to undergo modification. So we don't have the last word yet.
No, I suspect we'll be reporting on this as it develops.
All right. Let's move from here then to something we have not talked about in a really long time. That's in the journal Pediatrics, and it's evaluating child abuse.
This is an important topic, evaluating children with fractures, looking for evidence of physical abuse. The fractures end up being the second most common injury caused by child physical abuse. In fact, if you just look at fractures in general, in infants and toddlers, physical abuse is the cause of the fractures in 12 to 20%. What this article did was evaluate all the available data to try to give the clinicians some guidelines about when to suspect physical abuse. So they came up with several guidelines. They looked for specific radiologic findings in infants and toddlers that would suggest a high likelihood of abuse. Classic fractures in long bones, arms or in legs. Rib fractures, especially from the back of the child. Scapular fractures, spinous process fractures, and sternal fractures. When is a fracture suspicious for child abuse? And they said if there's no history of injury, if the history of the injury is really not plausible, if there are inconsistent histories or changing histories, if there's a fracture in a child that's not ambulating, if there are multiple fractures or fractures of different ages on x-ray, and lastly, if there's a delay in seeking care for an injury.
To me, it seems like this is the kind of information that needs to be available at the point of care so that caregivers can integrate it into their decision making.
To that end, this particular article provides very useful tables that are easy to review that highlight the things that I've mentioned.
Well, clearly something there ought to be a high index of suspicion for, and then some type of action plan if it's indicated.
And to that end, the American College of Radiology has actually developed specific practice guidelines for performing skeletal surveys in children that are suspected of being abused. There are 21 different images that should be obtained.
Well, kudos to these folks for putting this together in an easily accessible form. Finally, then, since we're talking about children, turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. And that's a look at our, again, recurring subject, but you've educated me a little bit on why this one's different, the incidence of childhood obesity in the U.S.
Let's take just a second and describe what most studies have done. They've reported prevalence of obesity as opposed to incidence. Prevalence means the total number of some health-related event that exists in a specific patient population at a particular point in time. For example, we might say the prevalence of obesity in children is 33%. The incidence means the number of new episodes of a particular illness that occurs during a specific time. And that's exactly what's reported in this issue, the incidence of childhood obesity in the United States. They did that by looking at a study that was started in 1998 called the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study, kindergarten class of 1998 to 99. There were almost 8,000 participants that were followed for over 50,000 person years. When the children entered kindergarten, 12.4% were already obese, and another 14.9% were overweight. Overweight five-year-olds were four times as likely as normal weight children to become obese. What this tells us is that the incident obesity between the ages of 5 and 14 years of age was more likely to have occurred at younger ages. It tells us that we actually need to improve primary and secondary efforts at a very young age. A couple things came out. The incidence was about the same across different races, but the incidence was higher in lower socioeconomic populations.
These sound like sort of garden variety recommendations that we've heard on a multitude of occasions. I wonder how this paper, how this study informs us differently with regard to practices that are already recommended.
I'm not sure that I, and I would say probably most of our listeners, appreciated the fact that this needs to occur before the children even enter school.
To me, this sounds like, once again, the onus is going to be on primary care physicians and especially family practice docs and pediatricians to educate parents and to also screen for this problem of overweight and obesity among their patient populations. That's one thing. And then the other thing is the availability of affordable foods that are not so calorie dense in neighborhoods in lower socioeconomic groups, which has been fingered as a big problem in promoting obesity.
Elizabeth, I really could not have said it better. I agree entirely with your points. By the way, that doesn't even mention ways to increase activity. To have safe zones where children can be involved in physical activity that increases their caloric expenditure.
On that note, then, I'm going to reveal that in the blog, I am going to talk about the FDA's report, so I'll share your pain in reading it. Also, just remind our listeners that our iTunes link has been restored. So for those of you who haven't updated your link yet, you can go ahead and do that and feel confident that you get to hear us all the time. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.